views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our Sunday Open Line Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. It's great to be back live after a week of being sick with bronchitis and having to delay my dental surgery until later in May. Hopefully, I'll get through the program without too many coughing attacks. It's still a lingering persistence for me. But we should be, as they say in the space industry, good to go. A couple of real quick comments, then I have a surprise first caller already on the line for us. This is Open Lines, so the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And as I said, I've got a caller on hold right now, so it will be busy. But we'll clear it up in a few minutes, and it will be available for your comments and contributions. Email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And then, of course, you can post comments on our blog, and I will get them almost immediately and can integrate them into the program. To find our blog, go to our website, thespaceshow.com, far right side to upcoming show menu. This Open Lines program should be the first program listed. And then open it up, that is our archive page, and scroll down, and that's where comments are. So you can comment without being logged into your Discuss or social media account. And that's the third way that you can get a hold of us if you have a comment or question for our Open Lines program today. On our spaceshow.com, we do have a very detailed website newsletter. I will upload it after our Space Show program ends today. And that'll be for the coming week. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website or very quickly download our program. There is a store, if you're interested in Space Show logo wear, coffee cups, things of that nature. So to find that, go to the menu in the upper left part of the website homepage, and you'll see a support menu. And in the support menu, you will find our Cafe Press store. You'll also find a Listen Live menu in that upper left menu quadrant, and that tells you how to listen to either live shows or archived shows. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me. And then, of course, the most important buttons on the entire website to me are the ones that keep us going, and you'll see that on the sort of center right part of the homepage for supporting the Space Show. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with giantleapfoundation.org. And we require financial support to keep our doors open. Simple as that. As a 501c3 nonprofit, we are offering tax deductions for those of you that pay federal U.S. taxes. And for those of you that do the same for California, we're a California public benefit corporation. Our parent nonprofit is giantleapfoundation.org. So if you have any questions, visit our parents' website or email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. But it is your contribution, your support, your financial gift that does keep the Space Show going. And we certainly appreciate those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us in the near future. Do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked. You are entitled to download our programs and to share them. There's a couple of rules about that. Don't do anything commercial with our programs. Don't edit them and put clips or cuts up on YouTube or any other website, including your own. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Please do read our full copyright statement. It is at the bottom of every one of the spaceshow.com website pages, as well as one giantleapfoundation.org website pages. So if you have any questions, do email me. and I'll be happy to respond to you. And we certainly thank you for your courtesy in that. We do have sponsors for the website, corporate sponsors. You can check out their banner ads going across our homepage. They do have things to say, so I would urge you to pay attention to our banner ads. But I also read a couple of sponsor messages. So for the first segment today, I'm happy to begin reading the sponsor messages again, given my break for the Space Foundation, as well as for having bronchitis. The Integrated Space Plan is our sponsor. This is the detailed 100-year forecast for the future, for our future in space. The plan includes Earth to orbit and reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by a base in the asteroid belt and the space settlements. You can see it at thespaceplan.com. When viewing the plan online, you can click on any of its 500 elements for more information. You can also buy a copy of the Integrated Space Plan poster off of their website, thespaceplan.com. It's huge. It's full color, but it's not interactive. Excuse me for my cell phone beeping at everybody. It is not interactive like it is on the website, but I have a copy of it. It's on the door to my radio studio, and I refer to it all the time, and I'm sure you will be very happy if you acquire a copy of it. thespaceplan.com. And remember, they have revised it, and they're announcing their revision at a big to-do at the ISDC conference later in May, put on by NSS at St. Louis. So we'll be doing some programming on that coming up in a week, I think. So you want to make sure you stay tuned for that ISDC program. And the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and as you know, I just completed attending my very first ever space symposium. It was the 33rd space symposium at Colorado Springs. We'll probably talk about it some more today. It was a great experience. I would recommend it for everybody. The 34th symposium is, well, I can't say it's just around the corner, but it's going to feel like it's just around the corner, April 16th to April 19th, 2018. I would recommend to everyone that you would attend it at least once. It is a different crowd of professionals that make policy and get things happening on the defense side, as well as the industry side, the commercial side, and the business side. And it's not like going to an advocacy conference at all. You'll make fabulous networking contacts. It's jam-packed. It's fun. A lot of social activity. And if you can do it, it's April 16th through the 19th, 2018. And again, it'll be headquartered out of the Broadmoor in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And those are our sponsors for the first segment. Our surprise caller is my friend and multiple space show guest and fabulous, fabulous artistic author, Tim Dooley. And he is back with us because he has a new book out in his series of Tales from the Alternate History, which is part of his Victorian Space Program in literature, which is nothing like it in the space world, in the sci-fi world. It is beyond first class. His artistic work is off the chart. I mean, you could, if you wanted to destroy his books, you could tear them out and frame the pictures, but I would not do that. So Tim is with us. I just got a hold of his latest, Two Ships, T-W-O, Ships, Tales from an Alternative History. Tim, welcome back to the Space Show. It's great to have you on for a few minutes. How you doing, my friend?
Oh, thanks, David. Yeah, it's good to be back. I'm doing good.
Two Ships, what's this one about?
Well, it's a story about a balloon ship in the 1500s and a starship from the 1800s. And they both get kind of pulled in through a sort of time porthole. And oddly enough, they end up in central Siberia, and they kind of have to help each other to get out of the situation they're in. It's a lot of the things that are going on in the backdrop of the story are part of a much larger story that's going to be covered over the course of this series. But it deals with these two captains and how they have to work together to get out of their situation that they're in.
And who are the two captains?
Well, the first one is a captain named Brewster Cobb, and Brewster is from Waco, Texas. He was survived the alternate history equivalent of the Civil War as a balloon observation person, and he kind of took to ballooning during the war, and he was part of a family that was very wealthy in the Rolls Oil business. And so he persuaded his father to spend company assets on a balloon ship that could sail down to South America to get exotic samples of plants and so forth. And they went ahead with the program and did just that. The other captain is one named Captain Lionheart, or P. Lionheart, who was also came from a very wealthy family in England. And Pete took on an interest in astronomy at a very, very young age. And he was years ahead of his time. When he was 12, he entered Cambridge University in England. And he came up with a theory of how to travel to dip stars by means of a space wave. And because he came to the conclusion that the reason why most of the mass in the universe was unaccounted for was because space itself was moving. And so he pursued his theory, and he developed the means of expanding and contracting space itself. And by doing so, he was able to generate what an effect called a space wave. It first came to him when he was out in the oceans diving, and there was a rolling surf that particular day, and he was just not too far below the surface, and there were all these fish swimming around him, but below he could see the kelp beds sweeping back and forth, and yet he had virtually no sensation of movement at all, and he noticed it was the same for the fish around him. So that led him to begin thinking that there could be similar instances of this occurring in nature, which eventually made him wonder if space itself was moving. And anyway, that's a brief look at the two captains.
What was the second captain's name again?
Pete Lionheart.
Pete, like Richard the Lionhearted, huh?
Yes.
Any relation?
No, but he was inspired by an aerospace engineer that I worked with for many years named Pete Lenhart.
For real?
And he's for real, yes. He works in the sensor industry, sensors that measure movement and vibration. And I worked with him for many, many years, and he's a brilliant engineer.
What technology got developed during this part of the alternative history?
Well, mostly this book deals with his development of the means of creating a space wave, and he was able to do that through the use of what he called a singularity device. I go over this early on in the book, where he had a castle built in a remote area of Arizona, of all places, where he could conduct his work unhindered. But he also had a close associate who developed an internal drive engine. Now, this associate, whose name is Margaret Dana, was another person who was years ahead of her time. And I am going to have a separate book, in fact, even a separate series on her as well. But right now we're dealing with Lionheart.
What is the website address for two ships?
Well, my website, there are a couple of places. One, it can be found listed on Amazon, of course.
Uh-huh.
But the other is my own website, which is Victorian Space Age. And you can open that up. And in the front area, there are certain things you can click on. And you can click on the section that says books. And that will take you into the page where I have my books listed. And Two Ships is the first one to come up.
So it's already up there.
Oh, yes. And you can scroll just below it where I have taken different pages from the book and have posted them online at the site so you can look into it. and see portions of it.
Okay, and it you know, just listeners, it has a lot of website pictures from the books and information on him as well. So you go all the way over to the far right to books, and that's how you find it, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and yeah, there it is. And this book has 48, boy, that's a lot of illustrations, and you do all of them, correct?
Yes.
And none of them are really repeated from other books, are there?
No, they aren't. These are all the first to come for this book. And once in a great while, you might see something that will be similar, but when I generate the image for it on the computer, I will probably have it from a different angle. Or it'll be something different about it. A similar scene, perhaps, but shot differently. Perhaps told from a different perspective of a character of that particular book where the image appears. That would be the only time that something like that would occur.
How long does it take you to do one of these books?
Well, this particular one took 7 months. And I was originally working on a follow-up story for Terraforming Venus. And I had a story in place, but I just wasn't quite happy with it. It was just missing something. So I decided to shelve it for a while and go off in a different direction in my history. And this is where I wound up.
Before we started talking, I told you I had a favorite picture on 120.
Yes.
But who is the Guardian?
Oh, the Guardian is, he's kind of a villain that is going to show up in a lot of my books. And he's called that by himself. What he did was, there's going to come a time that a way of time travel is going to be accidentally discovered. And this particular individual is kind of a villain. And what inspired, let me just give you a brief backdrop of him. The initial thought of him was, what would happen if somehow it turned out that Adolf Hitler, Genghis Khan, other notorious figures from history were all the same person who kept surfacing every now and then. And then he would go away, they think they killed him, but nobody really knows. And he keeps coming back as someone else. So the Guardian is actually this villain's future self who goes back into the past, and he tells an earlier version of himself things to do and things not to do.
Of course, that's a theme we see in a lot of movies. I just watched an old Star Trek series from the first Star Trek, where the guy that they were talking about was on another planet, but he was a good guy. He had been Brahms and he had been Da Vinci, and he hadn't been the evil guy.
Oh, I remember that one, yeah.
You know, and they just reran that, and I was watching it while I was laying in bed coughing my butt off. It actually holds up today, and then they got a time travel show on TV where Jack the Ripper has gotten hold of H.G. Wells' time machine and come into the future.
Oh, yes, I remember that one. I enjoyed that movie very much.
So they've got
Malcolm McDowell, I think.
Yeah, but they've made it into a weekly TV series now.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So that's a good theme. When does the time travel get developed?
It was developed in the 1830s, according to my alternate history, and Margaret Danner was the chief scientist behind it. And what she was actually trying to do was develop a portal so she could travel great distances by just stepping through a gate, and almost like would be dematerialized and beamed someplace else and would rematerialize. However, while she was adjusting certain parameters, a third porthole would open, but to a different time. And then they found out that they could actually, as the research continued, that they could begin to control where they're going to go. However, the whole thing was deemed too dangerous and discontinued.
They discontinued time travel?
Well, officially, yeah.
Wow, how disgusting.
But one of the backers of the project decided to create portholes of its own. And that's one thing to tell you about my villain. is that he originally came from China, and he worked as a gardener predominantly, worked in agriculture in China long, long time ago. And one of the things that he used to do was prune back trees and so forth so they would grow better.
Uh-huh.
Well, somehow in his mind, he had the thought that for humanity to grow, it has to be pruned back from time to time. And so he would, and he kind of enjoyed doing bad things. So it's kind of a dangerous combination, like as it is with most people who are villains. And when they go past a certain point, they actually think they're doing everybody a favor. They actually think they're doing good.
Uh-huh.
And so with him, if he killed millions of people by becoming a character who had authority, and after his job was done, he felt he actually did a service. And it was time to move on. So he's really a bad dude. I mean, he's and kind of odd. But one thing that's about him that's interesting is he's also kind of a prisoner of his own destiny that he can't escape from.
Interesting.
Yeah, kind of different. But more about him will come out as more books get released.
Do you have another one on the drawing board, so to speak?
Oh, yes, I'm working on it right now.
Which one is that?
It's the next one with Captain Lionheart. He's going to, he has gone back to the Alpha Centauri system. And in this current book, Two Ships, there's a little blurb and an illustration that shows the Elizabeth, his first starship, being attacked by a large creature. And right now, in the book I'm working on, I have gone back to that same planet. But now he's in a much larger ship, and he wants to observe the creature that attacked the first ship up close, where he had to flee for his life.
But that creature's not in Two Ships, is it?
It's only mentioned by the scars it left on the hull of the Elizabeth. It's on page 17, by the way, of the book that you have.
Okay. What else should listeners know about Two Ships that you think is enticing and intriguing? I mean, the pictures are fabulous. Like on page 82, you've got a Russian land steamer.
Yes.
You know, looks like it's doing something with the ice, right?
Yes, that vehicle is it's launching an iron mold into the earth, and what they did was, and this is another story that is I will be producing a book on. In fact, it's even talked about in this one called Siberian Kings. And it was about a shadow empire that was inside Russia back in the day. And they had an agreement with Moscow that as long as ore flowed to the West, they were allowed to run the empire as they saw fit. And it was one of the relatives of the Tsar. His name was Count Vladislav. And he was the one who sort of had this little mining empire. But iron moles don't necessarily dig tunnels. What they do is they go underground, they tunnel through the earth, and they stop the ship occasionally to collect ore samples. And then eventually the mole itself is kind of on a curving course to resurface later. And what they do is the ground behind them is recompacted. And if there is ore that is worth digging for, they'll go back to the original entry point and start digging it out by hand through the use of serfs. And the recompacted dirt is much easier to dig than normal solid ground. And they can go back to points of interest underground to do their mining.
What do you draw on to create these storylines? Are you an extensive science fiction reader and writer, short of the Victorian space age? Or,
yeah, where does it
come from?
I think a lot of it is it's a combination of things, really, like everyone else out there, I would imagine. You know, it's all the wonderful science fiction that's existed in books and in film and so forth. Also, I enjoy traveling. I have been to Russia. I've only seen just a little tiny piece of it, and I've been to a lot of other places on the earth that I hope to go back to. But just wondering of the possibilities that have could have gone on out there, that things that nobody knows about. And this sort of thing, I would imagine, generally, is rather common in science fiction today. You know, just because there are so many remote places, and nobody really knows the history of them completely. And just thinking about that, and that kind of the alternate history part of what I do was really my a world that I could escape to, I should say. And it's a world of imagination, and there's really no, it's virtually limitless. You can do anything you want. So that's kind of, I hope I answered that, your question.
Yeah, you have a vivid imagination and capability for creativity that, you know, we wouldn't think of developing a storyline like you're talking about.
Oh.
it's listeners, if you haven't enjoyed any of Tim's books, you're really missing out on a very pleasurable reading experience. And, you know, if you have kids at, I guess, what, middle school level?
Yeah.
Something like that. These are great, great reading books for them. So the print is not tiny. And, I mean, it's not huge like you're blind. But, you know, it's a good size for kids. The pictures will absolutely grab them and hold them with their attention. And the imagination in the pictures and the storyline is just off the shelf. I mean, even if your kids aren't space geeks, they will really, really enjoy reading these books. And I'm telling you, if you haven't seen them and if you haven't gotten hold of some of them, you're really missing out. That's about all I can say. They're fabulous. You're doing a great job. They belong in every school library, if you ask me, to stimulate kids' imaginations and stuff.
Well, so, thank you. It's a hobby that I really, really enjoy.
Well, one can tell that. When's the next one due out?
Oh, boy. I would like to have it out in a few months. I really can't say for sure. You know, there are a lot of things with me that kind of come into play.
Uh-huh.
As you know, I'm a cancer patient, and I kind of go in and out of chemo, and there are some other factors that come into play. But for myself personally, if I can get ideally what I would love to do is have a 6-month turnaround. I know that's awfully slow, but when you consider it's somebody who works in the aerospace industry and is doing this part time, you know, and has to overcome a few other things, that can be a good turnaround. But I would love to have the next one come out sometime over the holidays, or maybe, you know, somewhere around in there, but it's really hard to say.
You ought to have someone in alternative history create a cure for cancer.
Yeah.
From another planet or something.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's going to be a lot of things like that going on, you know, and as I'm sure you've no doubt have already spoken of with a lot of your guests on the show, that life is a lot more abundant than anyone ever imagined.
Yeah, they just haven't announced it formally yet.
Yes.
we're all waiting for the big pop. Tim, I'll let you go, and you let me know when your next one is out, and we'll talk to you again. And again, listeners, I can't promote this enough. I'll put the URLs for it all up in the archives of the show, so you'll be able to rapidly access this one and his other books in the series. And, boy, don't miss out on this opportunity. If you have children, boys and girls, you'll be doing them a great favor, plus yourself. So, Tim, take care of yourself, and we'll look forward to the next one.
Thanks, David.
Always sure. A pleasure, my friend. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So, listeners, that does clear our line, and I'm really not exaggerating when I talk to you about the Victorian Space Age and his Tales from the Alternate History. It's one of my favorite topics I get to talk about on the space show, and some of the favorite reading that I get to do. In terms of suggested topics for open lines, so first of all, I do want to provide everybody with the sad news that our friend Bill Melbourne passed away earlier in the week. We were fortunate to have him, you know, call the show briefly and talked to us with Paul Spoudis when he was on the show a couple of weeks ago. But Bill didn't make it, and he passed away, and we're very sorry to see him go and to his family. And he's a great guy, and the space show is now in his memory for today and all of this week. And Bill, rest easy, my friend, and you are missed. And I just wanted to let everybody know that. I had a long discussion about future programming on the space show today with Buzz Aldrin. So I talked with Buzz both before the space symposium and while he was there. And Buzz has some really great ideas for space development and commercial space development and space exploration and who he'd like to see as the next NASA administrator and a lot of really hot topics. So I'm trying to arrange a program with Buzz. It'll probably be a custom program on an early morning slot, which works best for him. But I will let you know when that happens. And you're gonna want to hear Buzz. So you can call in and talk to him. Don't ask him about what it was like walking on the moon. I think we've talked about this once before. You can get that from his other work. But Buzz wants to talk about some really creative visualizations, visionary ideas that he's got for Mars and the moon and space development. And it was a captivating 90-minute conversation with him, and I'm absolutely sure that you will find what he has to say when he returns to the space show to be really cool and doable, which makes it even better, so to speak. My next delayed dental surgery date, just for those of you who want to know, is May 23rd. So as it turns out, I have jury duty that Thursday, the 22nd. So I'm not going to change the dental appointment for jury duty. And since that's coming into Memorial Day weekend, I'm trusting that they'll comp a plea and I won't have to serve on jury duty. But there is always a question that I may be sitting on a jury on pain pills and wadding in my mouth. That'll be fun. But they deserve it. Dr. Splendor and all of his best. With four front teeth removed, I'll look like I'm from the Ozarks. We'll see what happens. But there's a chance my Friday show, which is set, might get delayed. I don't think because of the dental surgery, but because of jury duty. But I will have to keep everybody posted on that. It's just a heads up. It's a month away. And, you know, we'll see what happens. Another couple of things that happened during the week of my being down and out and coughing have to do with this issue that those of you who listen to the show a lot know that I harp and rant on, and that is just because something is talked about in the press, be it a credible piece of press or a crazy blog, doesn't make it real. And there is a difference in an actual policy that is underway and has timelines and has objectives to it and possibly already has some funding to it, and pontifications in various news magazines and news articles, even if the journalist is a good journalist, which is not usually the case to begin with. So I keep reminding people to stay grounded in reality and to not get carried away with space cadet visionary fever of something that may or may not ever happen. And if it does happen, it may be hundreds of years in the future. Stick with what is real and let's get development going. If you are a big believer in space settlement, and many of you who listen to this show are, what are you talking about settlement that's going to take place 300 or 400 years from now, if ever, when we can't even begin a settlement today, let alone develop a policy to support space settlement? So it just seems to me that a lot of people get excited and get sucked in to, you know, being captivated by something on their wish list or that they believe in, but they lose sight of the difficulties and getting something going today that can lead to that kind of visionary future down the road. And by the way, that was a part of what Buzz and I talked about today. Buzz and I were pretty much on the same page for all of this. So I just want to remind people it's okay to, you know, get excited about press articles that such and such is going to happen, and we're going to go to Mars in 20, I don't know, pick your date, pick your poison. But we don't have a Mars program. We don't have any funding for a Mars program. You know, Musk talks about his big rocket and his Mars program. There's no metal being bent here of any serious nature yet. I mean, yeah, get excited about it. M-Drive is another one. Get excited about it if you want. But, you know, we're a long ways from M-Drive propelling us any place. So let's get excited about the real progress that may happen and help make that progress happen so that these visions can materialize, if not in our lifetime, in the lifetime of our children or their children. I mean, that's how I see the world. Maybe I'm a stick in the mud. Maybe some of you want to talk about, you're 70 years old, Livingston, you're an old fart, you know, you're a geezer, you're not with it, you're not in the new digital age, you're not on and on and on. Well, maybe that's true. And so I'm willing to entertain your critiques on that. But to me, reading things that aren't real doesn't make them real and doesn't really excite me. That's just me. excuse me. So we can throw that out as a topic of discussion if you would like. And the phone line is open if anybody wants to call. Nobody's calling, so maybe nobody wants to do open lines today. That might be. I don't have a lot of great new space news. I do have some interesting programs coming up that I use this opportunity to tell you about to see if anybody wants to talk to us today. Robert Walker, our friend from England, is back with us tomorrow. So he posted an article about a week ago on why he wouldn't fly on a SpaceX spaceship to orbit the moon for anything. And I put the links on his Science 20 website to where you can read the article. But we're going to talk about that with Robert. And it's a safety issue with Robert. And we're also going to talk about some of other ideas that Robert has with the moon and with gravity and stuff. So as you know, Robert can be very controversial. He's very fast-talking UK guy. But we should have a lot of fun with Robert. He's a great guest, and he really inspires an awful lot of blog commentary. So I'm looking forward to tomorrow's program with him. Zimmerman is back with us on Tuesday night, always good. And Bob has published a paper in the Federalist on how the new Trump administration can really put a jump in commercial space development, going to the moon and other things. So I think I put the links for that in the website blog. I'll have the links to it in the newsletter. So, and if somehow I forget to do that, I'll make sure I reference his article in the comments on the blog section for Tuesday. Hotel Mars, which you know is pre-recorded, is going to feature Laura Montgomery, and she's going to be talking about property rights in the Outer Space Treaty. And a lot of this came about because of Zimmerman's article in the Federalist. And so Friday, Bruce Cortel is back with us on Maslow Windows, and sort of judging the first 100 days of the Trump administration on space happenings or potential happenings and in the context of Maslow Windows. And then Marcia Smith returns on Sunday. We were hoping to be further down the line on the NASA budget items, but we're not. And but Marcia's going to take us through whatever we know today on a proposed NASA budget, and we'll take a look at it. And there is none finer than Marcia. So I'm very excited about catching up with her again and talking with her again. We do have a caller who is patiently waiting on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to Open Lines. This is your host, David Livingston. Who are you? Where are you, please?
What do you mean, patient? I'm sitting up here in New Hampshire waiting for you to get done talking so I can talk.
Well, you have patience. You're an attorney. And you're supposed to have patience along with the BS that attorneys have, right?
Oh hell no. I'm not patient. Ask anybody who knows me really.
And you have to wait until the judge calls on you and all that crap, right?
Well, that's why I don't do a lot of court stuff, because, you know, sometimes the judge, you know, I'm kind of impatient like that. I don't do trial work. I do appellate work, but I'm not a big trial person.
So, listeners, in case you don't know, this is Michael Listener. And Michael just published another rousing, fabulous, wonderful issue of the Pressies, if I keep pronouncing that right. And, you know, if you're not a subscriber out there, listener, you're really missing a quality newsletter. And there's a lot of space newsletters out there that are good. You know that. But Michael is the only one that I know of that has a very well-documented footnote researched and opinionated on all sides. He doesn't just blow it out with his own sides. On space legal news stuff, and it's readable for the non-attorney, and it's fabulous. And if you know, I'm not just plugging it, but if you're not a regular receiver of it or a reader of it, you're missing out, because he's turning out a really excellent legal space news newsletter. So how do you like that, Michael?
I appreciate the endorsement. I hope the last newsletter, I hope I made it readable enough for y'all so you could understand where I was coming from.
I think you do, and I love the fact that you put so many footnotes and references in your work.
Well, I always document my work. I mean, I want people to be able to, you know, look at it, you know, look at it and be able to go back to it. But at most part, I don't want to steal, you know, plagiarism as a lawyer, I'm not going to call myself a scholar, because I'm not at that level, but I make sure to document my work when I publish. And even for my briefing letter, I make sure that I document it so I know that people, I'm not just pulling this out of the air or stealing somebody else's ideas, that I'm actually, when I quote something or quote an idea, I put a citation to it, or at least, you know, give it credit like it should be. That's the proper thing to do.
I will say one thing, other listeners, to sort of promote Michael, which is not really why he called. He doesn't just footnote his own work. So, you know, a lot of people will do a publication and then they'll reference and put citations in, and they're only footnoting their own work. What the hell is that all about? You know, when I did my academic work and my dissertation stuff, you didn't footnote. I mean, yeah, you could reference something that you had done. Obviously, that's permissible. But that's not really credible if all you do is represent and cite your own work. Well, Michael doesn't do that. And I think that really adds to the quality of your work. What's happening with space news? Are we about to pull out of the outer space treaty? Are we, you know, about to finally see property rights develop like so many people think? And what's this about Luxembourg having second thoughts maybe on their deep space mining activity?
Well, you know, I actually pulled the document down, the modification, right? It's in French, and I'm in the process of trying to translate it to, you know, a rough translation in English. But my understanding is basically they have some concerns about whether or not they can legally, you know, give these rights to their citizens. And so I wouldn't call it second thoughts as much as they're taking a pause and they're looking at it and they're modifying the draft law they've put out. So they're really giving this a lot of heavy consideration about, you know, whether or not this is something whether they can do it, but how they can do it, and whether the way that's being proposed is the proper way to do it. So I've got to get an English version of the document so I can really read for it. Here we go, plugging again. But I'll have a full write up on it in probably the second quarter issue of the Pressy on what's going on with that. But I think they're still full steam ahead, except the legislative body of Luxembourg is basically taking the time to really look at this hard and make sure they're not crossing any lines, or otherwise make sure that the way they do this is going to be acceptable to the international community. That's my understanding of it.
So what does that mean for property rights? Because, you know, the U.S. passed that 2015 December law that sort of got some sort of quasi-property rights. Is Luxembourg not signing on to that? Because the letter I read that you sent out, the article, says very definitively there are no space property rights.
Well, there are no real property rights. And this is kind of jumping the gun a little bit. The bottom line is, you cannot claim an asteroid like Eros, not like Mr. Nimitz claimed he did with the Eros asteroid. You can't do that, but the idea is you can claim the resources on it. The idea is you can do that in international law, collecting the resources. Even though the resources take, well, for example, if here in the state of New Hampshire, or I would, you know, if I wanted to harvest trees or something, or something along that line, I'd have to go to a property owner and ask them, could I harvest these trees? Because those trees are part of the real property. What the space resources thing says is those resources, there's no trees on an asteroid, obviously, but right. The minerals within on there aren't part of the real property of the celestial body. So while you cannot own the celestial body, you can go on there and through your activity of mining those resources, own them through that. It's a very delicate dance, and that's kind of one of the reasons I wrote this last issue, to try to explain this little intricate dance that's going on between domestic law versus international law, to help my subscribers understand, you know, what's going on, because we're seeing asteroid mining everywhere now, and it's just popping up in the media weekly.
Well, do we need to modify or get out of the OST, or is claiming resources okay as long as you're not claiming the celestial body?
Well, the assertion is that it's okay to collect the resources, but the problem is some companies don't, you know, some of these commercial entities, they just don't want the resources. They want to be able to say, I'm going to physically go to the moon or Mars or an asteroid and plant a base down there. I want to own the real estate to the exclusion of everybody else. And the way under the Outer Space Treaty, that is completely prohibited. In other words, let's go back to my favorite movie to jump on, The Martian, which annoyed me to no end when I was watching it, because they really muffed up the real reality of international space law. Ms. Watney was right, you know, when he was in the HAB, that was basically U.S. territory, or in the case since it was a multinational mission, the territory of all the nations participating. When he went out on the surface of Mars, it wasn't maritime law, like he explained. It was basically free access of outer space. That principle was basically created when Sputnik was launched in 1957. But under the Outer Space Treaty, even though that installation may belong to the U.S. and maybe a couple other nations, any other nation, say they decided to take a trip to Mars, could have stopped in, and they would have to open that facility up to those other astronauts or from those other nations, because of what the Outer Space Treaty says. So you can't occupy a section of extraterrestrial property to the exclusion of everybody else. You've got to open it up to inspection, and you just can't say, you know, no trespassers. If people want to come in, you've got to let them in, basically. And that's simplifying things a lot.
Open borders.
That's probably one way of putting it. On the flip side, there's another issue of, you know, kind of, quote, real property rights, in a sense, is geosynchronous orbit. Geo is a very interesting area because of, you know, the way you position satellites, and they stay in that one point and follow the Earth's rotation. So there's a limited number of slots. Because of that, there's a national body, the International Telecommunications Union, that basically allocates geosynchronous slots through licenses to different countries, depending on, you know, how much those countries, you know, their prestige, basically, you know, how much you're going to use and such like that. So, in a sense, those geo slots, and again, it's extremely simplified, those geo slots actually are, how can you say, it's almost like a no trespassing sign. It's that if you put a satellite there, you really don't have the right to go up there and try and, you know, bump it out of orbit, bump it off to the side for your satellite, because it's licensed through this international telecommunication to, say, the United States or the Soviet or Russia or China or even Iran, for that matter. Every nation has certain slots allocated to it in GEO.
Right.
So that's kind of a different animal altogether, and it's actually something that might in the future be used to actually, you know, start saying, well, we're going to let people, you know, license certain areas of, say, the moon or asteroids or such to other people. I don't know. I don't know where it's going, you know, and if people ask me, well, do you think the President Trump will, you know, get out of the outer space treaty? I don't know. I really don't have an answer. He's been in office less than 100 days. I don't, you know, it's plausible he could look at the outer space treaty again, but my guess is if anything like that's going to happen, it's going to be in a second term, not the first term. That's just my feeling on that.
What are you hearing about a new NASA administrator? Are you getting any scuttlebutt?
I know Representative Brinstein is basically, he's been for a couple, had a couple more interviews, I guess, or at least one other interview with the Trump administration about it. Again, I don't expect it to be a hot item. I think if we're lucky, you might see a new NASA administrator name probably by the end of summer.
End of summer?
Yeah.
That's a long time off.
Well, it's a low priority, but there are other positions that have to be filled within the administration that have a higher criticality. I guess I know there's an acting administrator. I forgot who the gentleman was, who the person was that's actually acting as that administrator. So it's really a low priority.
Lightfoot is a guy who is
is
doing the acting job.
So, I mean, I wouldn't really, you know, I mean, personally, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I think, you know, I understand the administration has other priorities on its plate. I mean, on top of that, they've got to start thinking about a new national space policy. Get that done.
Does the French election have any ramifications for their space policy?
I don't know. My guess would be no, probably not. It's granted, their elections do have geopolitical impact, but I think it would have more effect on EU policy, space policy, than it would for U.S. space policy.
Well, we're about to find out.
Because I'm pretty sure, if I remember correctly, U.S. Strategic Command entered in with has a MOU with them about space situational awareness with France. I know they just did one Belgium was the last one they did, and I think there's another one that happened just about a month ago, a few weeks ago as well. So, I mean, I think to that end, you know, the way we deal with these individual nations bilaterally, these types of MOUs or agreements and agreement quotes, isn't really going to be affected too much by the elections, because they do have interest to be able to, you know, work with us on matters of space situational awareness and such.
Okay. Anything else on your mind?
No, I was just one of the things I actually called in to talk about was basically, you know, I got into a debate with somebody, one of the quote astronaut candidates for Mars One about risk versus safety, and really it brought to the forefront of my mind that, you know what, we're not going to get really too far until we get out of this safety mindset and change the paradigm from safety, you know, keeping things safe, as to how can we, you know, how can we minimize risk, and what risk are we willing to accept? So I think that's been on my mind for the past few days or so. I think it's a huge difference. I think the whole safety thing is a political thing. Well, our friend Rand Sinberg would agree. But I think what we need is, you know, just one of those things where we need to start addressing space activities as these things are inherently risky anyways. The question is, for types of missions we want to do, what type of risk are we willing to accept? And get out of the safety thing, because safety is a part of, you know, mitigating risk.
Well, I can tell you from all the high quantity of interviews that I do, the overwhelming majority of people that are guests on the show and callers are very risk averse. And some habitual guests that come on the show that are really highly respected, I'm not going to mention names, they are sending me emails all the time about how the space cadets, and they don't refer to them affectionately like
right.
I do. They refer to them as name-calling, as if you're trying to make a conservative speech on the University of California campus. And they say these people talking about more risk, acceptable risk, all this, or, you know, wanting to kill people and don't understand. I mean, they're really super, super destructive and critical of the community that Rand and you and me to some degree, because I think the risk averseness is pretty crappy too. But I'm also not risking my life up there, but people aren't being compelled to do that. They're getting to make a choice if they want to do that. So, I chose to do some pretty risky things when I was young and healthy, with diving with sharks, all sorts of, other kinds of things that I did, skydiving without a lot of good training, and night diving in waters in the South Pacific with saltwater crocodiles. And I did a lot of really wild, crazy things, especially with scuba diving and cave diving and with, adverse creatures. And I had a great time, and I knew I was taking risk, and, you know, I chose to do it. And I think people can choose to take risk, and I believe in that.
I think my point is we're framing the whole argument in terms of safety, when it's basically about understanding this you know, launching rockets and space travel. And
they're never going to be safe anyway.
Is high risk.
Right.
And you can mitigate some of those risks, but, I mean, honestly, if you're going to be safe about the only safe thing about a rocket is you don't launch it to begin with.
Yeah, and then the only safe thing you can do is sit at home, but, you know, that may not even be safe. So
we're too much into the safety, the whole mindset of keeping space safe as a matter of looking at it from a risk perspective and saying, you know, this is risk. You know, this is an inherently risky activity. How can we mitigate the risk, so it's less risky. But at the same time, what level of risk are we willing to accept in order to perform a mission? And a lot of that's politics, I think.
Right. Now, I do think it's permissible and understandable for an employer, be it public or private, to put down some pretty stringent risk standards for people that are key participants in their corporate programs or their government programs, or that they want to set as standards for their people. But generally speaking, I don't believe that the government should tell me what I can and can't do. Although I do favor the motorcycle helmet law, and that goes to that. So nothing's ever black and white, Michael. It is, you know, some of these issues are complex. I remember one day years and years ago, after California passed the motorcycle helmet law, I was sitting in the ER with my son, who had to go in for some emergency CF treatment, and I was talking to one of the interns or residents in the department, and he said they were getting ready for a transplant, and I said, really, what happened? And he said a motorcycle death, lucky for the transplant victim that the guy was not right wearing a helmet, because the helmet law had really reduced the amount of transplants available. And so, you know, it can affect people on different sides of the street differently. So they're not black and white issues.
Well, it's just like informed consent, you know, for spaceflight participants. I mean, all these state liability laws, even the one that's on the governor's desk in Georgia right now, basically, you know, you have to have informed consent to understand, you know, that you got to basically sign away your life, or, you know, your life just in case. I mean, I always laugh. I said, you know what? If I ever drafted one of these informed consent agreements, the first sentence what I put in is, this is an inherently dangerous activity, and you could die. And just to get that in bold right at the beginning of it, and go through all the other mumbo jumbo,
legal
mumbo jumbo, but just get it right across. This is dangerous, and you could die. So,
I don't know. I think to be a college kid these days, you need informed consent to have sex, right? Or, you know, that could be dangerous under Title IX. You could be screwed forever. So that they've made it such that everything you want to do in life is going to need some sort of informed consent from the potential participants. Something as crazy as dating on college campus at a lot of colleges these days. And I say that tongue-in-cheek, but I'm really not that tongue-in-cheek because we've all read the news stories about what happens in these cases. And I think that there's a lot of overreach on safety. People should be able to be trusted to make assessments for their own life.
Well, but on the other hand, you get plethora of lawsuits because people sometimes don't think about this. Well, for example, do not touch stove. You know, if somebody burns their hands, you know, they can sue unless there is informed consent or a warning. So you have to have
stove
while hot. You know, just because you know we live in a very litigious society, and actually this whole informed consent thing is to protect. You know, is to basically keep a plethora of lawsuits come that would basically kill the industry before it got started, just like it almost did general aviation. But I think we need to get out of the political mindset of always being, of safety and basically into a risk and into a mantra of, this is a risky business. We can mitigate, we can decrease the risk in it. There's always going to be a certain amount of risk, and how much risk are we willing to take?
Well, Rand makes a very good point when he says, look, it's a very risky business, so if you're going to risk human life doing it, make the damn thing that you're doing worth the risk to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how I can find any fault with what Rand says about that. At least risk your life for something worth risking it for, not just some BS administrative thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think Rand makes a very good point about that.
Well, I concur with him on that point. I mean, I think it's a... I think until we get past that mindset, we're really not going to start doing, some seriously heavy things because, and it gets down to, the plethora of social media and people who call themselves journalists. I'm sorry, there's some people out there who aren't journalists who call themselves such, but just like you were speaking about earlier, a lot of things in the media that come off half-cocked. Look what happened with the Virgin Galactic accident.
Right.
A lot of people just pulled the trigger on, it was the engine. We told you about the engine. And they were just, they used to be basically a blunderbuss of, oh, my God, it's the engine, and just completely jumped to conclusions. I mean, a big media firestorm. And I got kind of caught up into it a little bit, too, regrettably, and I will not do that again. But the bottom line is, it turned out it wasn't the engine. It was something else. And this is the problem, and this is kind of the problem with spaceflight. If something happens in an inherently risky mission, I mean, the media can just go wild on it and can really kill it before it really gets a chance to say, okay, something happened, but this is a risky business. But it's before we ask the question, is it worth doing this? So that's kind of my thought. Other thing I want to say is Senator Cruz chairs the Senate Space Science and Competitive Subcommittee. That's basically a subcommittee of the Senate Commerce Committee, reducing regulatory barriers and expanding American free enterprise in space. That's on April 26th at 10 o'clock, and it's going to be webcast as well. And Robert Bigelow is going to be a witness, and our friend Andrew Rush is also going to be a witness on that panel.
Cool.
So I thought I'd just let you know about that as well. I actually wrote a letter and sent in a written testimony for that. So I'll definitely be tuning into that to see what goes with that. But I'm taking up my phone time and my battery's
right.
Getting a little low here. So
thank
I'll
you,
let
Michael.
You go and,
we'll talk to Michael in 2 weeks, everybody, Sunday, May 7th. Take care. Have a good week, Michael.
Yeah, you too.
Bye-bye. Listeners, the line is open, but I am going to take us to break. But I do want to say that the Zimmerman article I mentioned in the announcements a little while ago, if you want to find it in advance of Tuesday night, is titled How President Trump Could Jumpstart Space Settlements. And again, it is in the Federalist.com from April 17th. How President Trump Could Jumpstart Space Settlements, if you want to read that in advance of the space show program coming up, by all means, go and do that. And we are going to go take a short break. The phone number is available for those of you who want to call, and hopefully some of you will want to call us. It is 1-866-687-7223, and we will be back in about 3 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Sunday Open Lines program. We have a couple of sponsors for this segment. Orbital ATK is a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They're known as the partner that you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial venture, and defense programs. And also AIAA is a great sponsor. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, the world's largest aerospace pro society. They are with us. They have over 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They're busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, and increasing our knowledge of the universe, bringing us all closer together. Check them out at AIAA.org. If you're planning to attend Space 2017 in Orlando, let me know, as I am planning to attend and would like to catch up with you while in Orlando and the space coast of Florida. Celestis is a sponsor. They're the pioneer and global leader for Memorial Spaceflight Services since 1995, and they have their new DNA service we've been talking about. So now you can fly DNA of your loved one to the final frontier, and you don't necessarily have to fly their ashes. Thanks to a Celestis partnership with CG Labs of Canada, the world leader of DNA collection and home storage consumers, Celestis extends personal spaceflight options beyond memorial services to everyone on the planet today. This new service also stores your DNA off-planet through Celestis lunar and deep space missions and provides you a kit you can use to store your DNA at home. Moreover, families that choose traditional burial can still fly their deceased loved one's DNA on a Celestis mission, and you can fly your own DNA with your loved one. So check them out at Celestis.com for all of the complete and more information on that. John in Fremont is with us by telephone for our Open Lines program today. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hi, David.
What's up?
Yeah, I noticed that Woodward Lab and Heidi got a grant from NASA for their mock thruster efforts through the Space Studies Institute, and that's pretty exciting. I know that they were really needing some funding to keep the effort going. So I thought that was pretty exciting news.
I do too, and I really like them both very much, and I'm glad to hear that they run a very small and tight-fisted lab, and I'm sure 100K will go a long ways with them, and good for them.
Yeah, and I just have one other thing. I'm going to try and go to this Starship Congress put on by Icarus Interstellar down in Monterey in August. And it's the first week of August, so I thought that would be pretty interesting, too.
Is that the DARPA program?
No, it's a private effort. Icarus Interstellar is, I don't know if they have any DARPA funding.
Didn't they do the DARPA Starship 100 program a couple of years ago? Wasn't Icarus Interstellar a major part of that? I thought, in fact, they won the contest.
I didn't know it was associated with DARPA.
Well, I think they won the DARPA Starship Conference award. I'm not sure that there is any formal association with them. I haven't done a program with Icarus for quite a while, but they're a first-class organization, as you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I contributed to their Kickstarter effort to put on the last Starship Congress, but I wasn't able to go to that. That was down in Texas. So now it's relatively local. So and it's 2 days. I think it's a Monday and a Tuesday in the first week of August. I want to say the 7th and 8th, but I'd have to go check on that.
Well, you'll have to report on it for us, okay?
Will do.
Keep us posted on it when you go down there.
Okay.
What else is happening?
That's about it for me.
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, bye. Always a pleasure. Thank you, John.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Listeners, that makes our toll-free line available for those of you who would like to call in, and hopefully we will get some more calls before the end of the day. 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number, and email is drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. And, you know, they had at the Space Symposium, the New Shepard was there, you know, Bezos' rocket. I didn't see Jeff. He may have been there or not. I don't know. And the capsule was there. And I have to tell you, there were non-stop lines, weather permitting, to stand in line to go into the capsule. They ran, a 7-minute simulation program or something, and they would take 6 or 7 people in at a time to do it. I did not go into it, but I did stand outside and take pictures of both the rocket and the capsule. But it was non-stop from 8 o'clock in the morning until it got dark, weather permitting, because on one day it snowed, and that they had them covered up in plastic. Just thought I would throw that out there. Very popular exhibit. We have another caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is John Fort Worth.
Greetings, sir, and how are you today?
Pretty good. It was good to hear that news on the Mach thruster.
Yeah, I did not know that. I missed that announcement. So I'm glad that Fremont John told us about that, and I think that's good news. As you know, they run a very thrifty, small lab there, so I'm sure 100K will go a long way for them.
Oh, yeah, I think that will get them to the next stage, probably, considering the size and what they're doing.
And they make so much of their own equipment and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I saw a movie the other day, yesterday, and I thought I might mention it. It's kind of interesting, kind of a sort of STEM-related, I guess you'd call it. It's called Gifted, and it's basically it's kind of a debate about how you should educate very highly intelligent, almost prodigy level children. And the basic theme of the show was the plot was is that there's like this girl, I think about just about 7 or so, and she's somehow it's studying mathematics at a level that's basically college level at that point on her own. And they decide to send her off to ordinary grade school. or she gets asked answer questions like what's 1 plus 1 and what's 2 plus 2, and
so is that what did that turn out to be a good way to educate her?
Probably not, but at least it presents a kind of a drama that the rationale was is that if she was under the care of her uncle, who was trying to get her to be more socially acceptable or socially involved, I guess you'd say, with other children, because his sister had committed suicide. And she'd been pursued the opposite approach of being totally immersed from childhood up into this sort of thing, and the plot develops. But anyway, that's kind of I thought it was an interesting concept, though, is how you deal with things like that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, it's a nice name of the show is Gifted. It's a neat little show, actually. I suppose it'd be. A good date movie for somebody, too, because it kind of, you know, it's not just a normal blow-em-up, you know, Fast and Furious 8 kind of thing.
So is it in the regular theaters? Or?
Yeah, it is. I just saw it at one of the local theaters. I don't think it's in very wide distribution. Like, I don't think it's... I found it in about 1 out of 5 theaters in my immediate area.
Did it have anything to do with space technology or STEM or anything like that?
Well, I stem in the sense of it was about mathematics. I mean, her specialty was mathematics, and she was already into differential equations at home while they were trying to teach her basic arithmetic at school.
Well, I'll look for it.
It's kind of an interesting thing. And anyway, the grandmother gets involved in it, who thinks the girl should be put in a special school for the gifted, and it ends up in a big lawsuit. And, child custody scenario, and there's a few other details, I won't give on the whole plot, that led to the lawsuit having some chance of succeeding, and at any rate. But that's an interesting concept there. Another thing I saw at the beginning of it, in the attractions, which sort of related to climate issues, is apparently there's some promo for a show that's coming out with Al Gore, On climate issues.
Yeah, he has a new version of his global warming movie coming out.
And one of the points that he made that proved global warming was that the hurricane had caused the 9/11 memorial to be inundated with water.
I didn't know it was inundated with water.
Apparently, during the big hurricane up there, and it was a few years ago, the Sandy hurricane, I guess it was. At any rate, he was trying to give that as evidence for his idea of raising sea levels. I was like, no, it's because of a hurricane and water being blown inland.
Well, there's also a trench around. I don't know how many people have seen it, but I have seen it. And the wall, which is very, very dramatic, has, it's like an area around it that could easily fill up with water. Given the way it's designed, it's kind of like recessed into the ground and then it comes up from the ground. I don't know if I'm describing that correctly. It doesn't just sit flat on the surface or on an elevated base on the surface. It's like coming up from a pit is a disgraceful way to describe it. It's not a pit, but it's really done elegantly. It's an incredible design. But I could see it filling with water in a heavy storm.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying it has plenty to do with the fundamental level of the sea in the sense of, you know, the theory that ice is melting and the sea has a higher level.
Well,
I mean, even if it went up a few inches, it didn't cause this. The hurricane's what caused it.
Well, I guess not if you're Al Gore.
I just thought it was interesting, the immediate obvious misinformation that's in the coming attraction. I'm like, good grief. Anyway, it's another thing I ran across at the same viewing, and I thought it was kind of interesting.
What else is on your mind?
I guess we're waiting to see what happens on all these events there. But I guess I don't. That's just about it today. I just decided to make a quick call.
Well, the early results are in.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not early. I don't know because there is a time difference. But it appears that in the French elections, for anyone that's interested, it is not doesn't have anything to do with space, at least probably not very much. But Marine Le Pen is going to face off against Macron. They're the two winners, and the headlines say EU death march, EU death match. So I think Macron is the independent guy.
Yeah, that's somewhat he's supposed to be a centrist, I believe.
Or not as extreme right as they paint Marine Le Pen. I haven't followed it that closely.
No, he's more the moderate in it. I think he's in the middle of the spectrum. There's also a communist, I think, or some kind of socialist there.
Yeah, a Trotskyite, but he didn't get very far. But it looks like the runoff in 2 weeks will be between Marine Le Pen and Macron. So I'm not following it all that closely, so I don't really know what to think, and I also don't believe press reports about people or anything else anymore. I've become the ultimate cynic of the bastards behind the press and the headlines. So I don't know what to believe about either of these people, and I haven't taken the time to do my own due diligence because I can't vote for any of them. But it is interesting shifts in the world today. What I don't understand, and this is so far removed from space, I don't probably even shouldn't do it, but if you have any brains in your terrorist organization, why would you do an attack 2 days before an election to help get the most anti-candidate possible to win the election who hates your group and your religion? Why would you do something to facilitate that candidate winning? It would seem to me you'd want to lay low so that one of the more liberal independent candidates would win. You wouldn't want to do anything to inflame the far-right Marine Le Pen toward victory. So why would they do that unless they're really, really stupid or something else is at play?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I don't either. And as I said, this is so far removed from space that I'm just sitting here thinking.
These things tend to happen. I mean, why did Bin Laden issue a video saying don't vote Republican the Friday before the election in 2004. I mean, that was another interesting.
Well, I can see him wanting Democrats to win because he would fare better under
but
more liberal things.
But actually, Bush.
Well, it backfired. But I don't know. In anyway, it just sounds like there's more.
Another one. Why does Assad launch a nerve gas attack on civilians 4 days after the U.S. said that they didn't really see a need for him to be removed from power?
I don't know. There's probably
a cruise missile attack on one of his air bases.
Well,
I mean, that's another example of what you're talking about.
Well, yeah. So there's probably stuff going on that never makes it to the surface for we mortals. So this is another reason why I'm so skeptical about reading anything in the press, because I don't really know what goes on, and I don't think the press people know either. And what they tell us is probably not. Not always accurate. Who knows what dirty tricks are going on? I don't know.
Well, it's food for conspiracy theorists.
Absolutely. And you know, we don't do it on the air, but I talk about it. Speaking of conspiracy theorists, I am listeners coming back on Coast to Coast with George Nuri Tuesday night.
Yeah.
So they have asked me for a list of talking points. So I sent an email to a handful of people for very short. One line, and I'm really meaning this, if it's more than one line, I'm not going to even read the email, possible talking points that I can feed to Coast to Coast that I might be able to talk about during my 2 hours, because I'm not doing wacky spacecraft, I'm not doing UFOs, I'm doing real, honest, you know, space issues, like reusability is a big issue. This new stuff with Luxembourg could be a big issue. Outer space treaty and property rights are a big issue. You know, if you've got a hot-button issue and you can put it into one short sentence that makes sense, I'll consider it as part of my possible talking points that I send to Coast to Coast. But if you need to take up a whole paragraph or half a page, like some of you have done, good for you. You've had a really good creative writing experience, but don't expect me to carry your water for you. I want one succinct, short line of a hot-button talking point that I could throw out to the Coast team as a possible set of comments during my two-hour appearance on the show Tuesday night, which California time is 10 to 12. I'm going to be on the first segment. So if anyone wants to listen to Coast, that's a good time to listen to it. And if you have any ideas for talking points that I might want to throw out, those are the rules. One short sentence, succinct and to the point.
I thought should we withdraw from the outer
space? You did send one, and that's on my list.
That was one I threw out.
Yeah, I know, and that was on my list. But some people sent two paragraphs.
Yeah.
And it was so complex that there's no way I can sit there and take the time to distill it into a talking point for Coast to Coast.
Yeah, well, because of your restriction, I didn't bring up the idea of why does NASA shut off the camera on the space station every time something that looks like a UFO shows up.
I wouldn't bring that up anyway because I don't want to go down that road, especially with you, because we'll be hijacked for the rest of the show.
That was the first thought I had. I said, no, he doesn't want that.
But by the way, the UFO crowd was protesting the Space Symposium en masse. And every time, let's see, the program ended on Thursday. So every time on Wednesday, I would come out of the lecture hall where the big programs were being attended to, there were a crowd of protesters handing out packages of CDs. The truth is here, and it's being hidden. And it's all about the UFO cover-up. And they chose to actively protest the Space Symposium, which doesn't seem to me to be a great venue to protest that stuff, although everybody in military uniform was there, so maybe that was their market. Anyway, I'm not about to put any of these CDs in my computer because God knows what kind of cyber threats are on these CDs. I have no idea. But if you want them, John, and you're willing to put them in your computer and see what the literature is all about, email me your mailing address and I'll send them to you.
I don't know if I want my computer either. I had a bad experience with a virus a few months back. So
I met with a lot of people to arrange cyberspace space show programs on cyber threats. And one of the guys I met with, I still had the UFO stuff in my hand because I had just come from the meeting hall and I hadn't had a time to put all this crap in my briefcase. And the guy says, "You're not really planning to put that stuff in your computer, are you?" And I hadn't really thought about it. And I said, "Well, I might see what it's all about." And he says, "Well, I would advise you not to do it." And I said, "Why? Do you think the UFO people put stuff in it?" And he said, "Probably not, but you don't know what their source of material is and what codes may be in there from other sources that they're carrying on." He said, "I'd keep that as far away from your computer as possible." But I was going to offer it to you if you wanted it.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking is, you know, since you said there's a lot of military people and people officially in the aerospace business there, you know, a foreign actor could very well have put virus software in there, more like spy-type software in there.
That's what he was insinuating. That's what they were saying, that this happens all the time, and they would not put any software that anyone handed you, even if it comes in a package from Microsoft, in your computer, unless you can absolutely attest to the legitimate source of the software, and the same for a memory stick.
Well, I'm just saying it's possible. I mean, since that's a logical target for espionage, somebody could use something like that to front to try to get that into a official computer, and then put a Trojan horse in where they could actually access sensitive documents and real official material, you know.
Well, I've got the CD.
That'd be probably the real threat that would be there if that's real, you know what I mean?
Well, I've got the CDs, and since you don't want them, the first person who emails me their mailing address and wants them and will put the stuff in their computer and see what it is, I'll mail it to you.
Everybody needs to have a second computer that's sacrificable, right?
But I don't want – I'm not ever going to put them in my computer. I'm never going to open
like a second computer that was like your throwaway that you're prepared to wipe clean after you do it, I guess.
I don't have it. I'm not going to –
I know.
I'm not
just saying
hypothetically. But I will – if anyone wants them, I will you know, they still have the rubber bands on them from the symposium. If anybody wants the CD and the literature that I picked up, I'll be happy to mail it to you. It'll go to the first person who emails me with their mailing address. But the deal is you have to promise that you're going to put them in the computer and then tell John and me what happens.
Okay, yeah.
Because John and I are not going to do it.
More than likely, though, you won't notice anything. It could be something to wipe out your hard drive. Yeah, but more likely, if it's a real serious operation, they just put a Trojan horse on
you. Oh, yeah, and they're stealing your data and your credit card information or something.
Well, if it's an espionage effort, they really would be interested in seeing if they get a linked official document. So these people are generals or colonels.
Oh, yeah, a lot of them.
Aerospace executives or top scientists. I mean, you know.
But I can't imagine any of those people would put this crap on their computer.
Probably not, but I mean, I've run into things very recently in a work environment where somebody had sent a phishing email out, which looked like it was an official company email from the group that actually does cybersecurity, which really was trying to get people to compromise their computer.
Wouldn't surprise me, and you'd be surprised how many people fall for it.
Yeah, so that's a new threat. So there's some pretty sophisticated threats out there. You know.
Well, it's there for anyone who wants it and wants to take the risk. It's just sitting in my briefcase, and
okay.
I'll be happy to pass it on to anybody who wants it and wants to put it on their computer and see what it was all about. But
it may well be just a bunch of conspiratorial stuff.
Yeah, it totally impressed me as totally conspiratorial crap. Here, somebody may already want it. Let's see. Oh, no, Michael Listener wrote back, no way, not for me. What else, John? I got other people who want to use the phone.
Well, I think that'll be it for today, and
all right.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you for your call. Listeners, we're still got some time on open lines. The line is available for those of you who would like to call us. It is 1-866-687-7223. I haven't even read all the Xerox pages that came with the CD. You know, it's all just folded up in the rubber band package that I got when I walked out of the out of the lecture hall. So let's see. Kim Holder is. She says she wants the CDs in Mexico. Kim, you got to be kidding me. This could take out your entire Moonwords operation. Anyway, if you really want them, send me your mailing address in Mexico, and I will send them to you. Got another phone call. Good afternoon, listener. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Oh, you don't really want to put these on your computer, do you, Kim?
Oh, well, I wouldn't put them on my computer. Put them on an old computer that doesn't do anything else.
Well, email me your mailing address and you've got them.
Will do. No problem.
Do what?
I'll send you the mailing address.
Yeah, send me the mailing address. Don't put it out on air. And I'll send you the package I got from the symposium. And then you can tell us what's on it. But as John said, we probably wouldn't be able to detect if there was spyware on the CDs.
Yeah, it's not really my interest. I'm more interested in what how they're going to sell their pitch and the UFOs.
Well, they didn't do a very effective job out there protesting. You know, they had handmade signs that they were holding up. UFO conspiracies are here. They're here. Why are you covering it up? All this kind of crap. I think I took some pictures of them with my iPhone. I'm not 100% sure if I did that or not. But I wouldn't say they were particularly effective salespersons for their thing. But then I didn't open up any of their literature. I didn't even read their Xerox pages. I'm looking to see if I took any pictures of them.
Well, my husband sort of likes conspiracy theories. He's sort of a connoisseur, so he probably enjoyed them.
All right, email me your thing, and I'll go to the post office and send them to you. But that's not why you called.
No, actually, I was thinking about China's launch this week and their progress with their space station and their increasing capabilities. And I was looking at an article about it, and they seem to be nicely on track to have their their modules in place and have their space station up to three modules, a total of 60 metric tons, and with very nice graphic there, looking very much like a very mini ISS. And I just, you know, I really wish you could find someone who could talk about the Chinese space program, because, you know, they're becoming a player, and they can grow much more quickly than the American or the Russian space program grew initially, because now they're copying things that have already been done rather than having to invent everything. And, you know, once that space station is there, then does, you know, Russia still want to cooperate with the United States, or would they prefer to cooperate with China? And would China be interested in doing commercial things on their space station, or would it be entirely a government-run thing? You know, there's just so many things. I have no idea what the future of the Chinese space program is, but it's starting to seem really important.
Well, it's hard to find people that will talk openly on the radio about the China space program that really know anything about it. And, you know, I would love to find them. I don't know them, and I've not found them. There were people at the space symposium, but I didn't see any booths from China. There may have been a display booth from China, but I did see people from Vietnam and India and Japan, and I went up and talked to them about doing space shuttle programs. They were very, very hesitant, and on top of that, their English would have been almost impossible for me to understand using a telephone on a space shuttle program. So I have not followed through with any of them. They had really, really hard accents for me to deal with in person, face-to-face with them. But they were very apprehensive when I was talking to them about being on the space show. And as I said, I did not see anyone in the exhibit hall from China, although they might have had an exhibit there. I just didn't see it or recognize it. But the ones from Asia that I did talk to would be very, very difficult to work with.
Mm.
And I do think I saw people from China there walking around because of their name tags, but I did not get an opportunity to talk to any of them, and so I just think it's very hard. Now, there are Americans at think tanks that claim to know about the Chinese space program, and I hear them on the radio all the time, but you know, I've never been able to get some of them on the space show, and I'm not sure how accurate, you know, their information is to begin with. And I've talked to academics here that have gone over to China and spent a month there as a guest speaker in one of their universities or something like that, and they've given us their assessment of the Chinese space program. But that's not really what you're talking about. So I'm open to it, Kim. I am. If anybody has any ideas or suggestions for a true authority on the Chinese space program, I am absolutely open to doing that show. But this is probably the one area of the world where I have not been able to make any contacts or inroads in 16 years of doing the show.
Well, up until the most recent launch, it wasn't possible to even see streaming of Chinese launches, something that all the other space agencies do. But now, interestingly, if you want to see a stream of the launch, you can go to RT, which is a Russia-based news organization. And they don't do it on their America channel, but on their Spanish-language channel, they stream the launch live from the Chinese feed.
Wonder why they do it on the Spanish-language channel.
Well, I didn't check the other channels that RT has, but I imagine they just, the thing was that they wouldn't do it on the American channel. Like, there's probably politics behind there somewhere or other.
Well, again, I'll put out an appeal to possible guests. I'm certainly open to a Chinese space agency program, and if anybody can help me do it, please contact me at via email drspace@thespaceshow.com. What else is on your mind?
Well, there's certainly a lot of things floating around, and I wondered if I could try to phrase this right now, or I should think about it a bit more. But as I do my work for Moonroot, I've wondered more and more often as to where one finds research about that concern advanced colonies. You know, that's what I'm always looking for. Research things though, that have to do with not the first steps, which are things that we need to work on most, but something that starts to think about what happens if you got past the first step. And I've just started to really wonder if that's funded at all anywhere, and how somebody starts to approach that question. Because every time I try to pursue a new matter in this area, there's usually one or two papers that I find that are old, that are usually from the 70s or 80s, occasionally the 90s, that have to do with advanced structures. But there's only one or maybe two, and they peter out, and they're very preliminary, and that's that. But almost always, those one or two papers, to me, make the most sense, because they talk about what you could do if you had large infrastructure. And what makes sense once you have large infrastructure is really different than what makes sense when you're starting out. And that's the part that has to do with humans in the public. That's my mandate. And so I just, if anybody knows where you find stuff like that, I'd really love to hear about it.
Why don't you look at settlement history over time by various cultures and see how they evolved from initial steps to next steps? You probably have a lot of guidelines and lessons learned, especially if you looked at more than one culture for starting a settlement.
Is there some things that I've gotten just in very general reading that have to do with that? But those I've mostly used to support the point that once you get past the tipping point, everything changes. You know, the difference that railroads made to the settlement of the United States, the difference that large sailing vessels made to European influence around the world and the era of colonization and everything about that history.
So transportation plays a huge role in the settlement being able to get from one step of development to another. So if you have a space settlement, so you have the transportation to initially get the people there. So what are you going to do to develop transportation to further commerce and development of the settlement? So I would think that would be a good role model, although the transportation would clearly look different because you're not going to build a railroad to the space settlement. But you're going to have to use transportation differently than you initially used it to get there.
The thing is, transportation is something that has been investigated in every possible direction a great deal. I've had actually no trouble finding things that I think that to use the assumptions that I use, where there's very heavy investment by a broad consortium that does the technically wise thing rather than the politically expedient thing. There's lots of good options for transport. The thing is, how do you build there?
I don't know. You have to extrapolate what can you do with where you're trying to build a settlement. What is there? You know, mostly the settlements going west in the United States were based on resources of somewhat, in maybe cattle, maybe, you know, farming or something, but they weren't disassociated for the most part with somehow grabbing resources, because people came together to live someplace where they had resources, if not hunting or farming or abundant water or timber or something. There was always some kind of resource connected, and then they had a desire to get their production to some kind of market efficiently. So that's why the railroad would go to one place, or you'd have a spur of the railroad going to some place. you know, to connect you. So, you know, you want to go to the moon. So what are your commercial, you know, or potentially lucrative locations, and what are your products or services that would benefit from distribution and transportation networks? I mean, I would use the terrestrial model, but I would try to extrapolate into the space world of where you want your space settlement to be. You know, I was going to say, when I asked a similar question to Globus when he was on the show a couple of weeks ago about this low Earth orbit inclination, you know, thing for a space station, when I asked him how it ever becomes self-sufficient or whatever, and he said it never does. It's always dependent. So there isn't any real economic value to that. The value is in getting a settlement started to show that you can do it, sort of a demonstrator value. But if you're doing something further away than his equatorial orbit, you probably want to have some productive purpose for that settlement, and maybe transportation or something could serve that purpose. But you need to have some reason, I think, for the settlement to exist, rather than just saying, cool, we've got a space settlement now. Because if you just say, cool, we've got a space settlement, I think over time it'll perish.
Well, from what I remember of that interview, I think when he said that, what he meant was that the space station would always need to import vital supplies from Earth. But I think he did feel that it could be economically profitable, which is essentially amounts to the same thing. If you're economically profitable, you could argue that you're independent. But, you know, you still need those shipments.
He's not going to ever have independence in that thing. But you might have lunar independence, you know, or even a further out orbital space station, you know, free-flying settlement. If there's something that can be done on that settlement that allows it to act and behave independently. And I think that's up to the people who want to see that settlement happen to make the case for that. So I'm not as convinced that it's possible, so I'm not making the case for it.
Well, I have the thing is, I'm in a dilemma, because what I propose is not intended as a course of action that I'm recommending. But certainly in the timeline that I've used, there's a business model that I think, under the assumptions that I make, would work. It's just those assumptions are unlikely in terms of politics. But I definitely think there's a business model. It's just that in the reality we have to live with, it's a lot further out than it is in the paradigm that I use. But I think there's a lot of options in terms of businesses. You just have to invest very heavily first. And here I'll refer to Canadian history. In order to settle the western provinces, which Canada had a pretty weak claim over for quite some time because there was almost nobody there, they started simply giving people 40 acres of land as long as they agreed to go out and start farming it. And they did that for quite some time, and that's how those provinces were settled. The government just gave away land. And they were willing to do that. They were willing to pay for the railroad that went across it. There was no profit motive there. It cost them a ton. But they had a long-range plan. And that's the approach that I've taken with Moonlands, too. You've got to have a long-range plan.
Well, yeah, you do.
That's the main reason why I have structured Moonlands the way it is that I'm trying to pass a message to people that the thing is, you have to have a long-range plan.
Well, you do, but of course there's no land that they're going to give away on a space settlement and things like that. So you've got to be pretty creative in what your purposes for the settlement are going to be, in my opinion.
Well, I can only say, you know, I have the outline of what I'm using on Moonlands, on Moonlands.com, if people want to look at it. But if I was going to talk about that, obviously I'd do that
on a show.
Well, anytime you want to come back, let me know.
I will. I feel like I have to, every time I say I want to do a show, which I always do, but I have to get things ready before that, and I sort of devote part of my time after I say that to getting ready. And I don't have a plan this time, so I've been holding off a little bit. There's just the things I feel I have to have ready in order to make my case, and I just don't feel like I'm there.
Well, it's not an easy case to make, so and it's not going anyplace, so I would say spend your time and really cross your T's and dot your I's really well, and then come back and be profound.
I, of course, already think that I can make the case, but I just realized it's hard to make the case to people who haven't gone through it in detail. So that's the thing.
What else? Anything else you want to talk about?
No, if you're online, hopefully you'll get another caller or two.
Maybe, or I'll close it down. We're coming up on 2 hours. So, all right, Kim, thank you very much for giving us a call, and I'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye. Sure. So, listeners, we are coming up on 2 hours, and if somebody does want to call in, you need to do it in a hurry, because otherwise we'll shut down. 1-866-687-7223. Kim, don't forget to email me your mailing address, and I'll send you that stuff from the Space Symposium. And let me think if there's anybody. You know, this is an interesting show. We hardly got any emails for callers. The phone lines have been pretty busy the entire 2 hours that we've been doing the show. But normally we get a lot of emails and fewer calls, but that has not been the case for today. So, again, I much prefer phone calls, so I'm glad that that is the way the show has unfolded. Let me see if I can give you my upcoming schedule real quick. I did go over it for the week, but I've got some other, I've got some other open line shows coming up that I want to tell you about. So let's see if I can do it real quick. Okay, space not available. Okay, so here we go. All right, sorry for this. I should have been more prepared. Okay, so we've got, as I said, Marcia Smith is next Sunday. That's April 30th on the budget. So our ISDC show is with Ron Jones, who you've heard on with the Integrated Space Plan several times, and Christine Nobby, and that's going to be Monday, May 1st. A frequent guest on the space show, although he hadn't been on for a while, is Ted Spitzmiller, and he has an incredible new book on human spaceflight and related topics, and Dr. John Juris is co-hosting that show with me, and that is Tuesday, May 2nd. Really looking forward to that. Space Attorney Wayne White is back after a couple of years on Friday, May 5th. Michael Listener is back with us Sunday, May 7th. Dr. Mary Lynn Dittmar is May 8th. Patrick Collins was my original space show guest way back when. May 12th, and he's a space tourism guru, so he's in Japan, and we'll talk to him about that. Dr. David Grinspoon is a noted scientist, physicist, astrophysicist. Dave is with us May 12th. No show on Mother Day. Andrew Rush and Michael Snyder are with us, not about their Senate testimony that Michael talked about, but about their company Made in Space. We got another phone call. Just in the nick of time. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the space show. And who are you and where are you? And this sounds like we're going to have a lot of echo. Let's hope your phone line works.
Richard Easton from Dallas.
Hi, Richard. It's a lousy phone line. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to give you a quick Bill Milberg story.
Yeah, we talked about him early in the show and dedicated the show to him.
I couldn't make it to the funeral, but my wife was there, and she had a funny story that they told. As some people know, he was a gifted mimic, and he did his program about the evening with the presidents. And in 1973, he noticed a local businessman had a pro-Nixon sign. And, of course, this is when Watergate was already well-known and eventually took him down next year. So Bill called up the guy and pretended to be Nixon. He had Confederates typing in the background so it would sound, you know, like the president's calling, and totally pranked the guy. The guy, he got on the local news that Richard Nixon had called this local businessman who had a pro-Nixon sign, and it got a lot of publicity. And then eventually word got out that some unknown person had pranked this businessman, and there was much amusement about that. But then Bill started getting worried that he might get in trouble for impersonating the president. And he eventually called back the businessman from a gas station payphone and said, "Hi, it's me again." And the guy got real angry with him and said, "You embarrassed me." And he said, "I could trace this call." And Bill said, "Oh, you can do it too?" You know, going immediately into Nixon mode. So he was, he pulled that prank, I think, once in the White House mess where he pretended to be Reagan and had them swallowing it. Another time he called a famous French singer and pretended to be George H.W. Bush. So he had quite a sense of humor. And the world's less funny place with him being gone.
I'm surprised somebody didn't throw a voice like Bill would do out of the casket that would you know, probably blow some people's minds. "Hi, this is Richard Nixon, and I'm here to welcome you, Bill, for your great mimics of me, and to welcome you here to the other side," and have the voices coming out of the casket with a ventriloquist. Of course, that might have freaked the family out if they didn't know about it ahead of time, but that'd be a good parting story, don't you think?
Definitely.
So, anyway, you're right. The world is a less funnier place, and in the space world, lost a real friend, and it's too bad. So what can one say?
But at any rate,
life goes on, right?
Yes, alas, life goes on. Bill would want us to continue space exploration.
Absolutely. All right, Richard, my friend, thank you for the call, and it's a great way to conclude the space show today.
Have a good day.
You too. listeners, we do have an open line show coming up on Sunday, May 21st. The Space Frontier Foundation has their meeting this year in San Francisco, which is kind of weird. And Alexandra Hall is going to be our guest about the Space Frontier Foundation meeting on Monday, May 22nd, the day before my scheduled surgery. Scott Pace is our guest on May 26th, which may or may not get killed due to jury duty. We'll have to see how that plays out. I've canceled shows for Memorial Day. I usually do. That would be a Sunday and a Monday because that's part of the thing. Wallace Tucker is a guest we've never had on the show before. He wrote a really good book about Chandra's cosmos, dark matter, black holes, and other wonders revealed by NASA's premier X-ray observatory. I have a book. I've been going through it. This is going to be a really great show, and that will be on Tuesday, May 30th. Anyway, this schedule is all listed in the website newsletter, which I'll post shortly under upcoming attentions. Gwen Shotwell comes back on SpaceX Monday, June 5th. So really interested in catching up with Gwen. I ran into her at the space conference, at the space symposium, and it's always good to talk to Gwen. So, listeners, that's, excuse me, I'm timing this really well. I'm about to lose my voice again for this lousy bronchitis crap. And boy, I sure hope it goes away. Just like the problems for the San Francisco Giants, they need to go away. Thank you all for calling today and for participating. We really appreciate it and your contribution. And I wish everybody a great week, a safe week, a good space week. And keep looking up. And don't look down. Just keep looking up. And everybody, you know, keep it sane, keep it sober, stay grounded, and don't go off in la-la land, and just, you know, take care of yourself and your families, and everything else will take care of itself, too. Stay safe, my friends, and if you look up, let me know if you see a North Korean rocket coming toward California. I'm just kidding. And we look forward to hearing from Kim once she finds out what's on those CDs I'm about to send her. Thank you all very much, and goodbye from David, goodbye from all of you who called, and certainly goodbye from the Space Show.